Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest exciting and wintry and snowy adventure from Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. But, Ms. Jones, I'm feeling for you because you've not been sounding too good in the last day or two, and now it seems to have erupted into some kind of throat infection, but you're battling on, Miss Jones. You are a trooper, but are you all right?
I'm fine. Actually, I think I came out in sympathy with my brother, who we were all at my mother's on Sunday for a family celebration because my nephew came back from Australia. Wow. And so 25 of us gathered, you know, the clan and the house. Yeah. And my brother lives down at Bexhill on Sea. Mm-hmm. And so we all set off at about 5 o'clock to be sure that we would get home through the stormy weather, the snow was beginning to fall and so on. Yeah. They got as far as Roberts Bridge, mm-hmm. Which is probably about, in normal circumstances, about half an hour from their home. Mm-hmm. And my brother's Bentley came off the road.
Wow, his Bentley.
His Bentley, his big Bentley with his wife and his daughter and grandson in the car.
Yeah.
And they needed a tractor to come and tow them out of the ditch, but the tractor couldn't get through because there was a jackknifed lorry in the way, can you believe?
Right.
And they were out there until gone 1 o'clock in the morning. That's from leaving my mother's at 5 o'clock.
That's terrible, isn't it? Shocking, wintry conditions.
Well, I think the fact that they were out there in the snow and the ice all night long, I think my voice has come out in sympathy with them.
I think it must have done, yeah. I've been doing TV interviews last couple of days about how much I love the snow, you know, because you know me well, you know, I'm not a summer person, I'm a winter person. I love the snow, and I think the snow brings far more advantages than disadvantages. The terrible story you just told me about your brother and fact that you've got a bit of a bug or something like that is obviously very unfortunate, but just seeing kids playing snowballs, you know, in the street and all that kind of stuff, I think it's lovely. I think snow's magical, and that's why we put, you know, snow-covered trees on the front of our Christmas cards and all that kind of stuff. But
it is beautiful, but it is treacherous, isn't it?
Oh, it can be absolutely treacherous, yeah.
Did you ever ski when you were younger?
Well, I went on 2 skiing holidays with the school. I don't know if they still do it, but when you're about 14 or 15, you used to go on skiing holidays, and it was a great adventure because you went on the train from Chester to London. And none of us had ever been to London before. Okay, literally, never been to London. Can you imagine that? And then you, I don't know how we got across London, probably a coach or something. And then you got on the train that went down to Dover, but then the train drove onto the ferry. I mean, that's how old I am. And, you know,
the train went onto the ferry.
Yeah, the train carriages go onto the ferry. And then the ferry goes across the channel and then comes off at the other end, you know.
I never knew that. Yeah. Trains went
on ferries. Well, you know, that's my memory of it. And then you end up, after you've got to Paris, you end up getting onto another train called the Couchettes. And the Couchettes were like French trains that took you to Switzerland, but they were seats which converted into beds, into bunk beds. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah, the sleeper trains.
Yeah, sleeper trains, all that kind of stuff. And so it was a great adventure. And then I remember waking up and looking out of the window and the sheer magnificence of the Swiss mountains, you know, the Alps, you know, towering into the sky, the purple top mountains covered in snow and all that. I've never forgotten it. And I went on 2 of those and I always vowed that I'd, you know, want to do this for the rest of my life. It was so wonderful. And the skiing was great, just on the little nursery slopes and all that kind of stuff. But for some unknown reason, I've never, ever been back to a ski resort since.
It's strange, isn't it? When the kids were little, we used to go on regular ski holidays.
Oh, right.
And we went to a resort called Tignes-les-Brevières in France, mm-hmm. Which was just fantastic. And my daughter, my eldest daughter, she was a champion skier. She became captain of the ski team at Exeter University.
Wow.
And she was very, very wily about that. She said, I put in for captain so that I'd get free ski holidays throughout the winter every year. She did very well at that.
Good idea.
Yeah. I kind of miss those days. I wouldn't ski now because I'd probably break everything going.
Yeah, I'm sure you would.
I do remember that day, the day at the top of the mountain, sort of gone up in the lift, looking down, about to ski down, and losing my nerve.
Oh, right.
It just deserted me. I thought, I can't do this anymore.
I never went on anything other than a sort of medium type run, you know what I mean? And my mate, Alan Brazil, he's got three daughters. Two of them skied for Scotland and one skied for, excuse me, for Great Britain, okay? They did terribly well. Al used to ski when he was taking them skiing when they were kids, but now he just goes for the après ski. And even though he doesn't get on skis these days, he sends me pictures of the magnificent scenery as he's sitting on the balcony outside the chalet and all that kind of stuff. So I do wish I'd kind of pursued it a bit more. I think the difficulty is that it was, the scenery was great. The skiing wasn't that appealing to me. So I think I would have got bored after a few days just getting up and going skiing and then going and having lunch or whatever. But anyway, look, it's another world, isn't it? The weather struck everybody, and the rail strikes are going to cause terrible misery to everybody, because a mate of mine already has had to cancel about 10 lunches, I think, in London, you know, in the sort of city area of London, because people simply can't get from around the country to come and join them. And it's a terrible blow after we've had 2 years of, you know, really, really tough times because Christmas was closed. So I do feel sorry for the hospitality industry.
I do as well. Yeah, I mean, there's quite a few newspaper industry parties this week, and I think they'll be a bit depleted because people just can't guarantee they're going to get home after.
No, you're absolutely right. Shocking. I tell you where I did go since I've last seen you, Miss Jones. I went to see ABBA. I went to see...
Oh, yeah, I need to hear about it.
Yeah, the ABBA experience, you know, at the... I think it's near the O2, or it's next to the O2, isn't it? I'm not quite sure, but they had to build a special building to put it in because it needed so much technology. And
it's not actually in the O2 then?
No, it's in a building next door. They actually had to specially build a building because it needed so much technology. It would have taken a year to rewire any existing building, you know. And it is spectacular. You sit there. The nearest experience I can say it was to, have you been to see cinematic films in IMAX cinemas?
Yeah, I have. Somebody throws a snowball and it comes right at you in the auditorium. Yeah, it's fantastic.
It's like that. It's all around you. The music is pin sharp and fantastic. And they actually managed to project the figures of the four members of ABBA onto the stage as if they were real people. It's truly mind-blowing. And when I was watching that, I was thinking, now, why can't somebody do this with the Beatles, right? Because, obviously, we've got that great image of Paul McCartney playing at Glastonbury with John Lennon on the screen behind him. And I thought, that guy who did that Peter, what's his name, you know, did all the Lords of the Rings film.
Peter Jackson.
Peter Jackson, that's right. Surely he must be able to go and see the ABBA people. And because it was around about the same time, Beatles were in the 60s, ABBA in the 70s. Surely they can manage to rescue all that and do it, can't they?
Well, they don't need to go and see the ABBA people because according to some conversations I've had in the last 2 months, they are doing their own version of it.
You told me something new.
I was asked to get involved, yes.
An exclusive here on Planet Morgan.
Yeah, it's all to do with rights. It's all to do with music rights, and not just imagery rights, but music. Mm-hmm. And, there are various people in the frame. So those left are obviously Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr, and then Yoko Ono on behalf of John Lennon, and Olivia Harrison on behalf of George. Yeah. Plus a few other people who have a hand in the pie. So everybody has to agree and be on the same page before they can proceed with anything at all.
Golly, that is absolutely incredible, isn't it? But I'd love to see that as well. Talking about the Beatles, by the way, strangest story I came across recently on the Beatles. They made an LP with Frank Ifield.
They did. They
remember you.
What was he? The Australian crooner, wasn't he? Yeah, a very strange voice, sort of yodeling. Sounded like somebody was tearing a dog's legs off. Yeah. It was a horrible sound. Yeah. But they did do an album with, with Frank Highfield. Mm. It's a compilation LP released in 1964 by VJ Records, which is an American label. Yeah. And Brian Epstein orchestrated it 2 years before.
Really?
The reason it happened, there was a promoter called Arthur House who used to put on these package tours around the UK of lots of different artists. So each one would just jump on and play a couple of numbers. Off they come, on goes the next one. And they were very popular. They used to tour around cinemas and stuff like that. And Brian Epstein approached him because he wanted to get the Beatles on one of these package tours. Arthur agreed if they would do this compilation with Frank Highfield, which was promoted in America, believe it or not, as England's greatest recording stars in a copulation, which it said in the promotional material. Yeah. Instead of compilation, they called it a copulation. Oh, it was a classic spoonerism.
Yeah.
And it was known in the US as Jolly What?
As what?
They're very rare, by the way. You haven't got one of these, have you?
No, no. I read about it in a newspaper and thought, they've got that wrong. Beatles and Frank Highfield are like...
No, they haven't at all, but they're incredibly rare press and collector's items.
I bet they are.
If you've got one of those, you've got hundreds of thousands of pounds in your possession.
I'll go looking for one. Just because we always dwell on the Beatles on Life on Planet Porky, just before we leave the Beatles, I see that things are happening now at Abbey Road, and Abbey Road documentary being made by Mary McCartney, and I saw pictures of her and Ringo at the world famous recording studios last night. That's going to come out next year, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It'll be good. She's a good photographer and filmmaker.
Yep.
They were all there, weren't they? I saw Twiggy and Lee Lawson, her husband, were there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ringo and his wife, obviously Paul and Nancy, and Paul's daughters. I think James McCartney, the son, was there.
Yeah.
Giles Martin, he's obviously remastered various of the Beatles albums and so on.
I've never done the tour of Abbey Road, but you can do it, can't you? The average.
I tell you what, they've stopped doing the in-person tours.
Right.
It's very hard to get in there these days. But they were doing, I don't know if they're still doing it, but they were doing a virtual tour.
Oh.
So you could go online.
Yeah, I see, okay.
And do it that way.
I was always very disappointed. You know, for a year when I was doing my radio show, I kept putting requests in to the lady who was the chief executive of Abbey Road. And not only did we never get in, she never came back to me. And I thought, you know, why? You know, it's one of the world's famous, iconic buildings in the world of music and all that. But they seem to be very secretive. And I don't know whether that's because of the, you know, the sheer, I don't know, uniqueness and originality of Abbey Road.
It's all about what you know, who you know.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Chances are those emails of yours never got through to her.
Yeah.
Because there's a chain reaction in those things. But I've filmed in there.
Yeah.
I've gone in there to take photographs and take people around and so on.
Lovely.
Things have got a lot more tight in there these days.
Mm. What do you mean?
Well, they're less inclined to allow people
to have
a look around.
Yeah, sure. It's a bit like the Kremlin. You don't get it.
Without the Putin,
Sure. Talking about entertainment and going out and sorting out music, I see that you're getting around the jazz clubs now, Miss Jones. What's this about?
Well, you know, not exactly. Jazz clubs like Ronnie Scott's and Toulouse-Lautrec and all those kind of places, they use them for all kinds of music, not just jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to see a band, well, they're not really a band, they're a group called Flat and the Curves on Saturday night at the Toulouse-Lautrec Jazz Club.
Mm-hmm.
There are four girls, I don't know if you remember Fascinating Aida back in the 80s, who were, they did sort of very satirical, very racy songs, the four of them, wrote all their own material. Dilly Keen was one of them.
Dilly Keen.
I don't know if you remember her. She had a column on the Mail on Sunday at one point.
Oh, right, yeah.
Anyway, these girls flatten the curves. They deliver a similar kind of material, but it's I wouldn't say it's exactly feminist.
Mm-hmm.
But the first time I saw them a couple of years ago, there were a lot of very uncomfortable men in the audience. Now the men are at least half the audience, and it's all warmed up.
Mm.
They talk about very racy stuff, like the fact that young men these days watch a lot of pornography online,
mm-hmm.
and they get ideas from what they see that they want their girlfriends to try these things out.
Mm-hmm.
And these girls are saying, actually, girls, you don't have to do that stuff.
Right.
You know, this is not the way it should be going. And they call things out and they're very brave. And the song lyrics are incredibly clever. Right. They're really funny. They're really glamorous. And I would say watch out for them because they are really worth a night out.
Wow, that's fantastic. Now, Miss Jones, you're a woman with a very generous nature. And I like to think that I also try and help those in life who are less fortunate than me. So I was delighted to read this survey about the most generous cities. Manchester has kept top spot as Britain's most generous area for the second year running. It headed the table for donations to fundraising site GoFundMe ahead of neighbouring Salford. Belfast, Edinburgh and Glasgow were the next three. Now, this proves something which I've always said. I know that you have a sort of mixed geographical background with Kent and your antecedents in Wales, and you've worked all over the world and all that. But I'm a northern boy from Chester, and I love going back to the north, to Chester, to Newcastle, where I worked, to Liverpool, where my team Everton are, because I just find the people easier to talk to, a lot more friendly. And there's so little formality in the north that you get in the south. And it does not surprise me that the top five cities in this country of generosity to give to others are in the north of England.
It is a very interesting statistic, isn't it? Mm. I mean, I was in Scotland recently, as you know, and I had a brilliant time up there, primarily because the people I encountered were incredibly nice to me, very helpful, very generous. And I felt immediately embraced and included and all those things. I wonder if it's something about capital cities or, you know, primary cities. I know New York isn't the capital of the United States before a million people write in, but there is something about New York that is very hard and very impenetrable. Yes. And London can be the same.
Yes, I agree. I totally agree. There is something about that, you know, being in the sticks, I suppose people would call it, and all that. But it's just that I remember once doing doing the Open Golf, and it was at Royal Lytham St Anne's, right next door to Blackpool, okay? And people put Blackpool down terribly, but I like Blackpool a lot. You know, we used to go there when we were teenagers, night out and all that kind of stuff, you know. But the thing is, we decided to go late, so we didn't have any decent accommodation. There isn't a lot of decent accommodation in Blackpool, with the greatest respect to the town stroke city itself. But we ended up staying a little B&B, you know, in the back streets of Blackpool. And the people couldn't have been more helpful. You know, when you got to be, you know, right, so what do you want for your breakfast? Now, do you want a pork sausage? Do you want some tomato? Let me give you a bit of fried bread. Now, come on. You've got to keep your strength up if you're going out all day. All that kind of stuff, you know what I mean? Which you don't sort of get, certainly, in the south of England.
Do you not? I mean, I stay in a lot of different places. Yeah. I think most of the time, wherever I stay, people are very respectful and professional and nice to me. I think there is a rule that, you know, when you ask somebody, how were the people in, Auckland, where when you went there? And if you're a grumpy person, you say, oh, yeah, well, they were very grumpy. Yeah. And you could say, well, how you approach people is the way that people respond to you back.
Yeah.
You're a very friendly guy, so people are going to be friendly back to you. We're very chatty and open, aren't we, when we go anywhere? Yeah. But if you're contained and a bit kind of grumpy and not engaging, maybe that's how people come across to you.
Yes, no, you could be right. I talk to people all the time because I've still got my journalistic instincts that if you start chatting to people, you might find a story. You know what I mean? That sounds ridiculous, but I just always do. Because I remember one time I was sent on a story to North Wales and it didn't work out. But I ended up having to stay in, I think it was Merthyr Tydfil, right, in the middle of Wales, and got snowed in, funnily enough, that we're talking about.
That's where my family are from.
Is that right? Yeah. It was
originally, yes. Yeah. It's a terrible place now, by the way.
Well, okay. So anyway, you know, it was almost like a dream world. I couldn't get out because of the snow. Literally all the roads were blocked. There was only one place to stay, and that was like a pub stroke hotel in the middle of the town. I have no idea what it was called. So I go in there and I get talking to the barman and all that. And he said, and I told him I was a reporter for the Express and I'd gone to do this story, you know, about 10 miles away. It hadn't worked out. I was on my way back to Manchester, but, you know, the snow came down. He said, oh, yeah. He said, I thought you'd be here to do the story about the soldiers, you know. And I said, oh, what's up then? And, you know, Ireland was big at the time. The troubles were raging and all that. And when soldiers had finished a tour of duty in Belfast or Londonderry of 6 months. They then came to this holding camp somewhere near Merthyr Tydfil to sort of decompress, you know, to sort of relax after, you know, it's very stressful being a soldier in Northern Ireland, pacing the streets with an Armalite rifle in your hand and you know, at any time you could be cut down by a sniper or something like that. So they had to come and go. But the amazing thing was they all went into a bar in town somewhere and they started chatting to some girls. It always happens with soldiers. And then some local people, you know, local men, started attacking them, and the soldiers wouldn't retaliate, and they got beaten up. Although they were members of the British Army and highly professional soldiers, they got beaten up, suffered terrible injuries in some cases. They were kicked and all that because their training in Northern Ireland instilled into them, you do not retaliate to civilians.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, I suppose, yeah, they're very highly trained, yeah, aren't they? Yeah, and they would, yeah, know not to do that.
Yeah, but I don't know why I mentioned that. It's always struck with me, you know, just always talk to people and they might tell you something. Now, we talked about...
I was talking to somebody the other day who said when he was training journalists, yeah, that he always advise them to look at the classified ads because the number of times you could get stories out of the classifieds.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. You used to see things like, for instance, you'd see an advert in the paper saying recall of some toaster or something like that. You know what I mean? Kenwood.
Yeah, that's right. And Steve Harley, the Cockney Rebel, yeah, a singer-songwriter, was telling me that, well, he's got a song called Baby Shoes.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it was taken from an Ernest Hemingway, I might be wrong, yeah, somebody will correct me, Ernest Hemingway set a short story writing challenge,
right,
and it was six words, and it was for sale, baby shoes, never worn.
Blimey, yeah.
And
I see what you mean.
So Steve Harley wrote this whole song about the, you know, the theme behind baby shoes never worn.
Golly, that's amazing.
And you sometimes see that on Twitter, people, writers setting each other challenges.
Yeah.
Where they say, write a six word short story, leading on from this picture, and they post some picture or other.
Yeah. No, I don't mean about the toaster, for instance. So if I saw one of those, I'd get a reporter, ring up and find out what it's all about. And you'd suddenly find there were 250,000 toasters out there which could all blow up in an instant. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, great stories like that. But
there's a story in everything. Yeah. I think there is. You just got to open your eyes and look around.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. But we all, you know, we all get lazy, I think, in journalism and expect the story to come to us instead of us going to the story. Talking about North and South, Miss Jones, you put out a beautiful picture of Canterbury Cathedral this week. Yeah, obviously, you must have been in Canterbury. But what do you, you know, what is your, what's your admiration for Canterbury Cathedral based on?
So they've been cleaning it up. It had been blackened for a long, long time. Yep. It hadn't had a good sort of facelift for ages, had it? And they're doing it bit by bit. So some of it is still quite black and dirty. And the tower that I took the picture of with these gorgeous heraldic shields all around it, yep, in sort of jewel colours. But none of that was visible before. Now that they've cleaned it all up, you can really see the detail, and it's terribly intricate and, yep, wonderful.
Yeah.
And it's one of the most beautiful cathedrals in the land. And it's obviously the seat of the Anglican Church, yep, in our country and so on.
Yep.
Somewhere we don't go to enough. I remember going when I was a child, you know, you get taken on a school trip and you see the place where Thomas à Becket was supposed to have been killed. And,
yeah,
that doesn't mean a lot to you when you're 12, does it really? You're kind of looking to go home and watch Top of the Pops. But I'm much more interested in classical architecture and certainly, yeah, religious architecture now. And I'm hoping, if I can arrange my timetable, to go back to Canterbury Cathedral on Christmas Eve and attend the Evensong there.
That's right. We're going to a carol concert next week, aren't we, Miss Jones?
Oh, yes, we are.
Fantastic.
That will be at St. Bride's. St. Bride's Church on Fleet Street, yes.
We might have a bit of Christmas lunch in town.
I think it's got to be done, for sure.
Absolutely. Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for tuning in today to Life on Planet Porky. I rudely interrupted Miss Jones there just before the break, as she was talking about Canterbury Cathedral, because I wanted to also express my admiration for cathedrals. I love cathedrals. I was brought up in Chester. That's got a beautiful cathedral. Our annual carol service at the King's School Chester was always held in Chester Cathedral. And I used to stand there as a kid of about 10 and look up at the ceiling in the nave or whichever part of the cathedral we were in. And I just couldn't work out, Leslie Ann, how in those days, you know, this was built in like 1100. How did they get those huge stones right up to the top of the roof without electricity or hydraulics?
I know. Well, doesn't that take you right back to Stonehenge?
Yeah.
The great pyramids of Egypt.
Yes.
And I think we know that they had ropes and pulleys and they had the wheel by then, of course.
Yes.
So it was all just a question of manpower and strength and pulling things up and sort of building things from the ground upwards.
Some cathedrals took hundreds of years to build. I mean hundreds of years. Liverpool Anglican Cathedral was only finished in the early part of the 20th century and it was started about 400 or 500 years earlier. You know, so what I'm saying is whoever designed it could never have the satisfaction of seeing it built in his or her lifetime. Do you see what I mean?
Well, and of course, when they were designed, the designs evolved as time went on. You know, that wasn't the finished design, as it were. But more pieces were added
as
the centuries went down. Well, you know, the Sagrada Familia in Barcelona, that's still not finished. That's the Gaudi Cathedral.
Amazing, amazing, isn't it?
I've never gone inside because the queues have always been ridiculous.
Really long, yeah. I went to Cologne once for a football match and I stood in awe at the cathedral there in Cologne. It's two towers, right? Like two huge towers, a bit like York Minster, really, but they're more conal than square, if you see what I mean. It was the only building that never got levelled by the RAF. I mean, God must have been looking at it. You know, the same thing happened to St Paul's, didn't it, in London?
And Westminster Abbey,
Abbey, absolutely right, yeah.
St Bride's was flattened a few times during the Great Fire of London, for example,
exactly.
And during the Second World War.
Yeah.
But the tower, the Sir Christopher Wren Tower, which is the one that's like a wedding cake, as you know, always survived.
Amazing, isn't it? Absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
Now then, Miss Jones, I read a report saying 250,000 youngsters never want to get a job. They're 16, 17, 18, asked about their life ambitions, no ambition whatsoever to get a job. I don't know if you've seen that report, but it's very depressing.
It is, but I'm always very suspicious of those kinds of surveys.
Yep.
Nobody ever asks me, for example, you know, even when it's about the fields I work in, such as publishing, and they say, oh, you know, 60% of authors, non-fiction authors, and I think, well, no one even emailed me to ask me.
Yep.
So I'm always a little bit suspicious of them.
Mm.
I'm not sure that it's that they've got no intention of getting a job, as they don't expect to get one because of the way the economy and the workplace...
There's lots of vacancies. There's lots of vacancies. It's just that young people are so choosy these days about what they do. I was talking to my niece, actually, who's got a very successful career in surveying. She's a, you know, qualified surveyor and she deals with big developments, you know, commercial and residential and all that kind of stuff. And her company takes people on. And she said to me that she had an assistant and she asked this assistant to get this report finished. And she wanted it, you know, to be available to her the following morning because she had a meeting with somebody else in the company. It needed to be finished. And the young assistant she'd taken on, who was 22, said, well, I'll do as much as I can up till 5 o'clock, but I'm sorry I'm leaving them because I'm having dinner with my father. Now, can you imagine if you said that to Paul Dacre or David English in the days when you were working on the Daily Mail?
Well, we would have been fired for it then.
Of course you would.
But I think that there are very strict employment rules nowadays and hours are more confined and you're not required to do unpaid overtime anymore.
What's unpaid overtime and what is commitment to your job?
Well, say your hours are 9 to 5 and there's a project that's going to take you into overtime. Say you've got to be there till 7:30 or something to get a project finished.
Yeah.
That's outside of your hours. So technically, they need to address your contract and they need to say, right, you will be receiving time and a half for these additional hours that you've worked this week.
Yeah.
But if that is never brought up before the agreement is made to do the overtime, then the employee doesn't have to do it. And if they fire you for that, you can take them to a tribunal for unfair dismissal.
I know, it's outrageous. Think of the times when we were young reporters and we went out on literally four-day stakeouts, okay? So, you know, something terrible had happened. You're waiting for somebody to come home. You're staking out the house, you know, morning, noon and night. And you're there for 4 days until the person actually turns up again. What do you do at 5 o'clock? Ring your news desk and say, right, okay, it's 5 o'clock now. You better send somebody else. I'm going home. I mean, that is unthinkable in our business.
It is, but I think it was also reflected in our salaries, that we were paid better than most because the job was flexible. We had to be available at a moment's notice, and we might get sent on a job and not come back for 3 months.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I know that. Yeah. Drives me mad. Now, my friend Eamon Holmes, okay?
Oh, yeah. We like Eamon.
We like Eamon very much indeed. Now, Eamon's had a glittering career. Sometimes I get up at 3 o'clock in the night, you know, in the morning, I might need
to go to the bathroom.
Well, maybe go to the bathroom, or maybe I need a glass of water, or maybe I just can't sleep. I've always had an early gene in my head saying get up at sort of, you know, 5 o'clock or 5:30 or something like that. And sometimes it comes a bit earlier. But occasionally when I do, I see a tweet from Eamon, and he's tweeting out to say, anybody else having trouble sleeping tonight, you know, and he suffers from insomnia. And we then exchange messages, you know what I mean? And I sent him one recently saying, try every episode of The English Eamon. It's very good. It won't send you to sleep, but it'll give you something to do, you know? And he said, oh, my thanks very much, and all that kind of stuff. But insomnia can be a terrible, shocking thing, you know, because you're living in a almost like a zombie-type world, and it's very odd to be up and about at 3 o'clock in the morning when literally nothing else is happening.
I think, again, it's about expectations.
Yeah.
We know that as we grow older, we need less sleep because we're not growing. Our cellular turnover isn't as great as it used to be.
Yeah, right. I didn't know that.
Yeah. No. So we're not expending the energy that we once did.
Yeah.
My grandfather used to stay with us quite a lot when we were children, and he was in his 80s by then. He was always up and about the house around 3 o'clock in the morning. He'd polish all the kids' shoes. All our shoes would be lined up by the front door, all beautifully paired and shiny. He'd go for a walk around the garden and feed the birds, and he'd get the breakfast table ready and do all that kind of thing. And I think, you know, my mother, she goes to bed about 7:38 in the evening. She's 87. Yeah. She's always up at 4 because the paper man comes at 4 with her newspapers.
Golly.
She doesn't like him shoving them through the letterbox because they get all ripped.
Right.
So she's always there waiting at the door with the door open to take them off him.
Right. Yeah,
and I just think we have to get used to not needing as much sleep as we once did.
Yeah. And conversely, I remember when the very niece I'm talking to you about, and I've got a nephew as well, were like teenagers. You couldn't get him out of bed before 11 or 12 o'clock in the morning, you know, when it was holiday time. They just didn't get up. But
look at the growing they were doing at that point in their lives.
Well, yeah, I suppose you're right. Talking about genes, by the way, I read another report saying, and it's from Penn State University, Pennsylvania, obviously, and it says that not enough consideration is given to people with drink problems because drunkenness can actually be in your genes when you're born. You just have a desire for drink and there's nothing you can do about it.
I think that's true. In my father's side of the family, there's certainly alcoholism. How did I say it? Alcoholism.
Alcoholism.
I mean, if that doesn't tell you, then I don't know what does.
On the sherry earlier, Miss Jones, no?
But yeah, going back through our family, there were always drink problems. My uncle Cliff, who played famously for Spurs and Wales, when he stopped playing football, he developed a drink problem and Alcohol Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous, because in his case, he just could not get his head around the fact that he couldn't play football anymore.
Sure. Yeah.
I had a cousin who died from overindulging in booze. My dad used to like a drink. I like a drink.
Yeah.
It's a question of keeping a lid on it and knowing when enough is enough.
Yeah, no, I tell you.
But lots of people don't have that yardstick. But I do think it is in the genes, definitely.
Well, I think there's something about it in the genes. George Best, for instance, obviously had a terrible problem. And people often ignore the fact that George's mother died of alcoholism when I think she was about 56 or something like that.
Did she? I didn't know she did.
Yeah, she did. And not wanting to personalise it, but of my four grandparents, three of them were alcoholics who I never met. And the other one I met twice in the whole of my life. The second time only at my dad's funeral. And if you think about it, that was coming out of the Second World War on Merseyside, Birkenhead and Liverpool, which were terribly badly bombed by the Germans because their shipyards were there, not just the where the Royal Navy ships docked, but where they were built at Camelaird's, the shipbuilders. And, you know, it must have been a very stressful life. And if you had any sort of gene in your system which needed triggering, that sort of thing would trigger it, you know what I mean?
Oh, definitely. I mean, hardship, it's one of those things. Yeah. You want to drink yourself into oblivion. Yeah. I think when we were on Fleet Street, it was part of the culture, first of all, to be a bit hard drinking.
Yes.
I can remember a period of time when I was doing about three bottles of wine a day.
Yes, that's right.
And it wasn't even touching the sides.
No, I agree.
So you'd go over to the wine press if you were in Fleet Street. You'd go over for lunch, you'd have a bottle. You'd go over at the end of the day, have another bottle.
Yeah.
Then go out to a gig and it'd be another bottle.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Never even felt drunk. Mm. But then when I noticed it, when I was pregnant with my first child, I stopped drinking, of course. Mm-hmm. And I never regained that capacity afterwards. I became a lightweight drinker after that. Because mm-hmm. I just couldn't have more than about three drinks without being sick, frankly.
No, right. Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, that's a good thing.
Just to be a bit graphic about
it. No, but I mean, that's a good thing because that then nature gave you a natural break on excessive drinking, which is probably very good. If you take it to its extreme, because I've had this argument put to me before, should people who are in jail for life, say in America on death row or something like that, in 100 years' time, will we have the attitude now that it wasn't their fault? They were born with a gene in their body which made them a killer.
Well, that is a very profound question, one that I cannot answer.
No, exactly.
But we could have scenarios in the future, well into the future, where families are suing governments for having incarcerated their family member when it could be proved that their instinct was to kill other humans and they couldn't be blamed.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. You know, if it's something you're born with, so what do? Do you say, well, you can't let that person roam freely in society because they have a gene or an instinct, their body don't want to kill people? What do? You have to put them into some sort of secure unit. Does that mean they're in jail? I don't know.
Well, you've got to protect society, as you say.
Exactly.
That's the primary concern of any government.
Exactly.
You've got to protect wider society from dangerous individuals.
Yeah.
You also have to protect dangerous individuals from themselves.
Yes. No, I totally agree. But, you know, you go back 300 or 400 years when it was normal to hang children for stealing a loaf of bread or something like that. And that was perfectly normal in those days. And you think, my God, you know.
Well, it was also normal to stuff children up chimneys, wasn't it? And to send children down mines to open trapdoors. And children lost limbs. They were maimed. There were terrible things went on. A whole lot of stuff was considered normal back in past centuries because we weren't yet enlightened.
No, I totally agree. It's all getting a bit dark, this, isn't it, Miss Jones?
So that is a bit.
Let's lighten it up a bit and talk about Harry and Meghan.
Have you watched it?
Well, I watched the first three, okay, because I knew I was going to be asked about it on the TV show I was doing. So I thought I found it utterly boring, completely misleading from the trailer that had gone out, and nothing new, and actually ludicrous in the arguments they're putting forward and highly insulting to the Queen when I saw Meghan making fun of having to curtsy to Her Majesty, the late Her Majesty, the Queen. I'm sorry, if I ever had any sympathy for Meghan, she lost it after that.
Okay, I feel the opposite.
Yeah.
I did watch the first three episodes.
Yeah.
I came out with a softened view, feeling really quite sorry for them.
Right.
Why? Because the palace seems to have been duplicitous. Harry made the point that the palace was prepared to lie to protect William, but they weren't prepared to tell the truth about him and Meghan. Mm. And I did come away, as did my daughter, who watched it with me, feeling that we had far more sympathy for Harry and Meghan than we realised.
Well, I think they're trying to smash the royal family to pieces. I don't know what they're going to do after this series for the $88 million they've got, because there's nothing left to tell. But anyway, look.
I don't think they need to do anything after this. I think they just wanted to get their viewpoint across in their own words. Yeah. And as they said, who better to do it? Everybody else is writing about us and saying what they like. Mm. Why shouldn't we have our say? And I agree with that.
Yeah, but you've got to get up in the morning and have a purpose in life. And
Nobody said that when Prince Charles did his interview with Jonathan Dimbleby, for example.
Yeah, yeah, except that, you know, Charles has a role in life and Harry doesn't, unfortunately.
And well, that is the problem. And it's not Harry's fault that he doesn't have a role in life.
Well, he did have a role. He was in the army, made himself a role, and then he...
He went to Botswana. He did all that wonderful work building villages with children and local people out there. Yeah. Then he was in the army for 10 years. But you can't stay in the army forever. Mm.
No,
and look at all the work he did in Afghanistan. That's all been negated now by our pulling out of Afghanistan.
Yeah. No, totally
what does somebody like Harry do?
Well, honestly, that's going to be the question now for the next four decades. Now, Miss Jones, if I sing this to you, golden brown, texture like snow. I don't know the next line, but who is that?
Stranglers.
Exactly. And the reason I sing that to you is that, sadly, their drummer, a guy called Jet Black, has died at the age of 84. They were quite an influential band, the Stranglers, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. It was sort of proto-punk, wasn't it? It was. There was something quite melodic about the sort of angry music that they made, which set them apart from the others, really.
Yeah.
I was very interested to read about Jet Black because I didn't know much about him.
Yeah,
he died in North Wales, but he wasn't from North Wales. Yeah. He was from Essex originally.
Right.
He made all his money. He had quite a substantial fortune.
Mm.
He made his money running a fleet of ice cream vans. And he also had an off license in Guildford. Yeah, he had a fleet of ice cream vans, and he had an off license in Guildford where he originally met Hugh Cornwell, the singer of the Stranglers.
Right.
And through a Melody Maker ad. But did you know he had atrial fibrillation?
No, what's that?
Well, it's a heart condition.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And he actually died of a chest infection.
Oh, dear. Well,
yeah.
If you've got a chest infection, you've got a dodgy heart, as I know to my cost. It's really rough, believe me.
It's not a good combination. Mm. On the other hand, let's point out that he was 84 years of age.
Yes.
I tend to think that, you know, these days everyone thinks we're going to live forever because it's routinely common for people to live to 90 now.
Yeah.
When I was a child, you couldn't buy a birthday card for a 90-year-old, you know, with a 90 on it.
No, you couldn't, no.
But now they're common in the card shops, as are cards for people who are 100.
Yeah.
So I think there is an expectation that everyone's going to live to 90 or 100, whereas actually 84 is a really good age.
Yeah, well, funny enough, my mum was 85 when she died, God rest her soul. But I think she'd started not to enjoy life as much, you know what I mean? It sort of gets to you that way. But anyway, look, just it's sorry to have to talk to people who've passed on, and Jet Black's one of them, but he had a good life.
He did have a good life.
He also had a good life. It was Richard Shepherd, who sadly has also died, who was the joint founder and then eventual owner of Langan's Brasserie. And I think
I would say he had far too good a life,
far too good a life. And the guy that he founded the restaurant with, Peter Langan, not many people know this, Peter Langan died when he was pissed at home and a cigarette dropped out of his mouth and set fire to the house. And
oh, no, I didn't know
they
that.
He died in the blaze at the...
God, he went out in a blaze of glory.
But the one guy I do want to talk about, and you'll have seen some tributes to him as well, is Johnny Johnson, the last dam buster, okay? A remarkable story. He died at the age of 101. He was the last member of the dam buster crew. 18 planes took off that night to bomb the dams on the Ruhr, and only 8 of the planes came back. Half of the crew were lost. Half of the whole crew of Bomber Command during the Second World War were lost. So if you joined up with Bomber Command, you had a 1 in 2 chance of being killed. I mean, you know, the odds of you doing more than 3 missions were amazing. But just to explain my admiration for this boy, when Johnny Johnson was 22 years of age, he was lying in the belly of an Avro Lancaster flying over the Sorpe Dam. That was the third dam they had to bomb. at 60 feet from the actual height of the water. 60 feet, right? And obviously the pilot of the plane, he was aged 24, by the way, had to keep it on a steady line. And Johnny's job as bomb aimer, well, he had a button in his hand attached to a cord. And the minute that he thought he was in the right place, he had to push that button to release this huge bomb, which had to drop on top of the dam. The Saw Bay Dam needed bombing from the top. It wasn't where you could put the bouncing bomb in, which was used on the other two, okay? Because it was so solidly built with earth surroundings, the bomb had to go from the top. Do you know, he made the pilot do that run 10 times. 10 times. The first 9 times, he said, no, skip, go around again. We haven't got it right yet. And every time they came back in, of course, they were being attacked by the German guns, which could have blown them out the sky at any time. And, well, you know, you ask young people these days, what were you doing at 22? And that was Johnny Johnson.
The courage of these men is extraordinary. I used to go to a lunch twice a year that was one of the, you know, the blue plaque lunches.
Yes.
Where they put blue plaques up on the buildings around London.
Yes.
And they'd have a lunch at this Regent's Park Hotel afterwards. Mm. And off he'd go. And Bomber Command, the last remaining pilots from Bomber Command, yeah, were the guests of honour at this lunch.
Fantastic.
I never understood the connection, but they used to come along. Mm. And in the beginning, there were about 6 of them still alive. And there would come a point in proceedings where the host of the day would invite us all to be upstanding to raise our glasses to these guys,
yeah,
the last remaining bombers. Mm. And you know, the numbers dwindled over the years. I think there were about 2 of them left in the end.
Yeah.
But I was always had mixed feelings about this. My father was a tremendous pacifist.
Mm.
And he hated things like the Remembrance Day service, mm, at Albert Hall, when, you know, the Queen would come, all the royal family,
yeah,
and all the services would march through the auditorium and everyone would clap and cheer and they'd,
yeah,
all wondrous sort of celebration. My father would say that it was glorifying war and he couldn't stand it,
yeah,
anything that glorifies killing people. And so I have that streak in me, really,
mm,
that should we be glorifying these bombers who, you know, vast numbers of civilians died because of them.
Yeah.
I know they didn't have a choice, mm, and I know that's what warfare is all about,
mm,
but it always boils down to the death of innocents, and that's,
yeah,
the thing that really... It hurts me.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate all your sentiments. My father fought in the Second World War. He joined up when he was 17 in 1940. And again,
wow,
what were you doing at 17? And he joined the Royal,
yeah,
Navy.
Yeah.
He was torpedoed in the Atlantic when he was 21, and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, they didn't talk a lot about it after the war, actually, people who served in the war. But the one
point, They never did. My grandfather didn't either.
Exactly. But, you know, the one point he always made was, look, we didn't start it. We had to defend our country and we had to do whatever it took. But anyway, there we are. Right.
But isn't it just awful,
yeah,
that here we are in the 21st century and what's going on in Ukraine?
Incredible.
We should not be in this position at this stage in the game.
Incredible. We thought when the Berlin Wall came down, we thought when the European Common Market was built, and a lot of the reason for the EU was to make sure nations never went to war again in Europe, right? And Berlin Wall came down, so Cold War had gone. We couldn't foresee that ever be a war again, a war in Europe like it's going on now. But there you go, it's another story, Miss Jones. Right, okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for having joined myself and Miss Jones today. And I think it's fair to say, Miss Jones, we'll be back with you again, this time next week. I like Blackpool a lot, you know, we used to go there when we were teenagers, nights out and all that kind of stuff, you know. But the thing is, we decided to go late, so we didn't have any decent accommodation. There isn't a lot of decent accommodation in Blackpool, with the greatest respect to the town stroke city itself. But we ended up staying a little B&B, you know, in the back streets of Blackpool. And the people couldn't have been more helpful, you know, when you've got a bit of... You know, right, so what do you want for your breakfast? Now, do you want a pork sausage? Do you want some tomato? Let me give you a bit of fried bread. Now, come on, you've got to keep your strength up if you're going out all day. All that kind of stuff, you know what I mean? I've always had an early gene in my head saying get up at sort of, you know, 5 o'clock or 5:30 or something like that. And sometimes it comes a bit earlier. But occasionally when I do, I see a tweet from Eamon. and he's tweeting out to say, anybody else having trouble sleeping tonight, you know, and he suffers from insomnia. And we then exchange messages, you know what I mean? And I sent him one recently saying, try every episode of The English Amen. It's very good. It won't send you to sleep, but it'll give you something to do, you know? And he said, oh, my thanks very much, and all that kind of stuff.
There's a story in everything. Yeah. I think there is. You've just got to open your eyes and look around. Yeah.